Well, yesterday I discussed a great number of the, what I called preliminaries to get us focused now on where we're going for this series on anthropogenesis. And today I want to start out with what I've called the pattern, because HPB repeats this for us at the beginning of the second set of shlokas or stanzas. And you recall I'm really going to just refer to them by the number of the shloka or verse, because it really doesn't make much difference. There is a division which HPB gives in volume 2 into stanzas, but since the verses or shlokas are numbered consecutively, it's easier just to refer to those. And at the outset, page 24 of volume 2, she points up the what she has already given as a summary at the end of volume 1 of the cosmogonic process, cosmogenesis. And this pattern is in a sense repeated, and I've tried to somewhat diagram it, but it's not easy to diagram it at all, and then have given here the kind of summary, the connective tissue which Ashish provides in a very succinct paragraph in Man, Son of Man, this which I certainly recommend. And this is also, I think, still in the early part of it, which probably Sri Krishna Prem produced. In any way, she says that that summary of the whole cosmogonic process, which constitutes volume 1 of the Secret Doctrine, showed the coming out of the eternal into cosmos and time. And remember, she is suggesting that this, and she's following here, of course, Dr. Wilder, who was an early member of the Theosophical Society, what he gives as the definition of Genesis. And I think it's a very useful definition of Genesis, not as creation, and certainly not as creation ex nihilo, but rather a reemergence, a coming out of the eternal, or that condition in which we have the very first shloka of stanza 1, the eternal parent was asleep again for 7 eternities. An emergence out of that into a manifested condition. And when I say manifested condition, be sure you remember, this is not visibility in terms of our physical eyes, that I see this desk or this book or that mountain or whatever. Not visibility in that sense, but manifestation in the sense that it is present in pre-physical form. How shall we say it? You know, that it's there, not in physical form yet, but certainly available for molding. And so it comes out of the eternal into cosmos and time of all existent things. Friend John Reuchlin isn't here this morning. I think he may have been able to make it, but every time I use the word thing, I expect John to prick up his ears in the back row there. Anyway, Bill, you can tell him I dared to use all existent things. Everything. The entire multiplicity of existence takes its rise in and from, as H.P. Blavatsky puts it, one and the same point, which is the one universal, immutable, eternal, and absolute unity. In its primary manifested aspect, we have seen it become, first of all, in the sphere of objectivity, primordial substance and force. And remember, in volume one, she calls that force bohat, but she doesn't repeat that term at this point, so I've used force. And in the world of metaphysics, the spirit of the universe, or cosmic ideation, called by some the Logos. And then she states, and this is page 24, in volume 1, the classification given here of cosmic ultimates at the commencement of a great manvantara, the period of actual manifestation, Parabrahman manifests as Mula Prakriti. Now I've put this here, that nice little scribble, as a kind of veil, because it is said, you remember in volume one, that there is between that which is out of all knowable relationship, the absolute. Those of you who are here for Henrik Skolimowski's theories remember my suggestion that the theosophical worldview is firmly rooted in this concept of an absolute, which is beyond all speculation, as the Upanishads say, beyond all knowability, speakability, as the Upanishads have it. And so there is a veil, it is said. And in one of the occult commentaries, this veil is similar to the breath which you exude on a cold morning, that film, if you know. You go out this morning, you probably saw your breath, you see. And so that's a kind of veil which it is said not even the highest Dhyani Chohans penetrate. When a property emerges, exhibits itself, root, mula, of course, root, primordial, prakriti, that which will now become causative from kri, that which now produces all causes, or as we simply say, root matter. Not a very good translation, really. So she says, at the commencement, then, of a great manvantara, Parabrahman manifests as Mula Prakriti and then as the Logos. Now that makes it fairly simple. But I've put one there because in a sense this is the first Logos. This Logos is equivalent to the unconscious universal mind of Western pantheists. It constitutes the basis of the subject side of manifested existence, which is, of course, primordial substance, or primordial consciousness, pre-cosmic ideation, if you like. And the subject side is the source of manifested being and is the source of all manifestations of individual consciousness. Mula Prakriti, or primordial cosmic substance, is the foundation of the object side of things, the basis of all objective evolution and cosmogenesis. Force, then, she says, does not emerge with primordial substance from parabrahmic latency. It is the transformation of into energy of the supraconscious thought of the Logos. So it's the transformation which brings about, you remember, in the first volume, exhibits the lawfulness in the universe, in the manifested system. Or as she puts it, it impresses on primordial substance the laws of nature. The laws which are, I always feel like the axial structure present in crystals, which exhibit themselves then, which are not there until there is that which can produce their exhibition. And so she says, it is the transformation into energy of the supraconscious thought of the Logos infused into the objectivation of the latter out of potential latency in the one reality. Hence spring the wondrous laws of matter. Force, thus, is not synchronous with the first objectivation of Mula Prakriti, but as apart from it, the latter is absolutely and necessarily inert, a mere abstraction, it is unnecessary to weave too fine a cobweb of subtleties as to the order of succession of the cosmic ultimates. I'm very happy that, because it's true, here's where language does fail us, doesn't it? So I'm glad she says it. We don't need to worry about too fine a cobweb of subtleties, she puts it. Force succeeds Mula Prakriti, but minus force, Mula Prakriti is for all practical intents and purposes non-existent. So, you see, after all, we're still, in one sense, in a realm of duration. Time was not, for it lay in sleep in the infinite bosom of duration, you remember. So this is why it succeeds it, and yet must be present simultaneously with it in order for Mula Prakriti, or this original cosmic substance, this primordial matter, primordial causative element, to be active. Then she continues, from this summary of the cosmic universal process, which we've already had in volume one, exhibiting as universal mind or divine mind, universal consciousness, Mahat. Remember the word that we found in volume one, the Sanskrit term, Mahat, which really just means great, but is used as universal mind or consciousness. She now continues to give us the basis for anthropogenesis. The heavenly man, Tetragrammaton, who is the protagonist, the firstborn from the passive deity and the first manifestation of that deity's shadow, is the universal form and idea which engenders the manifested logos. And so I've put two here because, in a sense, this is the second logos, as she continues. It is Admon Cadmon, or the four-lettered symbol in the Kabbalah of the universe itself, also called the second logos. And this gives the pattern, the heavenly man, for our system. For our system. The second springs from the first and develops the third triangle, and she refers us to the Sephirothal tree, which I'm not going to attempt to put up, but you can get that in the Kabbalistic studies, from the last of which the lower host of angels, men, are generated. It is with this third aspect that we shall deal at present. So this is why we begin to see this link, a pattern. And so it is suggested, this man pattern, if you like, is the pattern for our whole system. And indeed, she suggests that every being in the universe tends to become man. That is to say, not in physical form, but rather tends to become conscious, to unite that which is subject consciousness with form through intelligence, through mind, which is what gives us that definition of man, which Annie Besant, of course, gives as that being in the universe, in whatever part of the universe we find him, in whom highest spirit and lowest matter are joined by intelligence. This becomes then the pattern throughout. And HPB therefore continues in the same commentary, this is page 25, man as regarded in several systems as the third logos, because now he is by virtue of this a creator. As she says, man as regarded in several systems as the third logos, the esoteric meaning of the word logos, speech or word, verbum, is the rendering in objective expression of the concealed thought. So the thought, of course, is in one sense here in the divine, universal mind, divine mind, maha, revealing itself through image after image. The Logos is the mirror reflecting divine mind, and the universe is the mirror of the Logos, though the latter is the esse, that is the be-ness of the universe. As the Logos reflects all in the universe of Pleroma, so man reflects in himself all that he sees and finds in his universe, the earth. That's a marvelous statement, and it's page 25, of course, of volume 2. And let me read it again, because I think it gives us also the esoteric doctrine, which is today being very much recognized in terms of the fact that the universe is what we perceive it to be. The importance of our perception, the participatory universe. So let me just read this again. As the Logos reflects all in the universe of Pleroma, so man reflects in himself all that he sees and finds in his universe, the earth. You remember one of the points I stressed yesterday is this correspondence between the state of the earth, the stage development of the earth, and man, his stage of development, you see. But beyond that, also, it is really a matter of perception, is it not? Very clearly, a matter of what we perceive. And so the reflection is, in that sense, always how I see the universe. Now, the first shlokas that we are given in this second volume move us directly from this cosmic level of reflection to our immediate position. A lot has been omitted. We're sped down. It's, you know, the tape has gone forward very fast. The video is, you know, on fast forward and sped up. And suddenly, we are now to our immediate position on this fourth globe of our planetary chain, in the midst of a new round on that chain. The fourth round has begun. You see, three rounds finished. And so the whole videotape has sped up, and suddenly, but here is the pattern, do you see? A lot has been omitted, as I pointed out yesterday. But the pattern is there, and that's what's important. And in terms, then, of the pattern, we can place these shlokas in the series of cosmic events. And that's why Ashish, in Man, Son of Man, page 66, puts it this way, which is very helpful. The powers of the archetypes, that is here, powers of the archetypes, this universal consciousness, have ordered the ideal patterns of the Arupa universe. Because we are dealing, of course, still with the formless, the Arupa. All is ready for the divine Arupa to reflect itself into Chayaloka. Chaya, of course, the Sanskrit, actually simply means shadow. Simply means shadow. It's often used for the etheric mold. Loka, that is to say, the region, sphere, locality. So all is ready for this to reflect itself in the Chaya Loka, and the armies of sparks and energies are waiting for the order of the third Logos. Because here now comes the creative, the third Logos as that which is human, create, which will thrust them out into externality. It's a marvelous little paragraph that Ashish has there. Let me just read it again. The powers of the archetypes have ordered the ideal patterns of the Arupa universe. All is ready for the divine Arupa to reflect itself in Chayaloka, and the armies of sparks and energies are waiting for the order of the third logos, create, which will thrust them out into externality. And that's why now we will have the manifested images. Hence it is suggested that the only way we can come to the archetypes is through their images. Of course, that's very Jungian, as you may know. And so what we are seeing all about us is a reflection of a reflection, and that's what we ourselves are, reflections of reflections. Diana? With this fundamental pattern in mind, let's turn to the first shloka. Thoroughly, I think you were, something of this bothered you, did it, or?
Well, but that was about 20 sentences ago.
Oh,
I had a hard time bringing it up now.
Oh. Sorry.
No problem.
Okay. Well, let's turn to shloka one then. I think it'll be nice to get into these shlokas, and I think we have time before the coffee break to get into this. Shloka 1 reads, I haven't put it on the board, so I'll read it. The law, L-H-A, which is a term we will have to become familiar with here in this whole pattern. The law, for those of you who don't have the book before you, the law which turns the fourth, and she has in parenthesis, globe, or our earth, is subservient to the laws of the seven, the planetary spirits. They who revolve, driving their chariots around their Lord, the one eye of our world, Loka Shaksu. His breath gave life to the seven, it gave light to the first. They are all dragons of wisdom. Wonderful. Shloka. Marvelous. All right. Now, remember that the first four shlokas, which HPB gives us in Volume 2, she groups together, terming the section Beginnings of Sentient Life. But that, of course, was really the theme of the final stanza of Volume 1, The Beginning of Sentient Life. When attention, of course, was then focused on the unique formulation of life inherent in all the levels of the manifested universe and capable of structuring itself in terms of sentient existence. In one sense, then, that stanza, including the exposition of cosmogenesis, gave us the pattern. And now that pattern is reiterated as a prelude to the study of anthropogenesis. First, then, as we've said, in this first shloka, we have what Ashish calls the golden key to the whole cosmic pattern. The specific reference is to our globe, the fourth, as the shloka calls it. And you remember the planetary chains, we're not going to go into that again, in which, of course, we are the fourth, this earth, and we are once reminded of a fundamental principle in the esoteric philosophy, the underlying pattern, which is really basic to the entire theosophical worldview. The outer is dependent on the inner, and even the inner is dependent upon and takes its rise from what here in the stanza, in the shloka, is called the one eye, that which is the witnessing consciousness within whose grasp the whole of being is held. Everything, all beings, all existence revolves around that one, now called the one eye. One eye, in other words, is the, and Ashish puts it this way, the hub of the world wheel around which the sevenfold archetypal pattern revolves. From him come all the patterns of existing being, and from his life breath all things take their living reality. Or in the Christian terminology, in him we live and move and have our being.
Would that be the heavenly man?
Yes, in this case. Now, this symbolism, I think, is powerful and very beautiful. Here, the one witness, the witnessing consciousness, heavenly man, if you like, is termed Loka Shakti. I just have to be very sure of my spelling here. Literally, the I, Shakshu, is I of, and here we have Loka again, or field or region of manifestation. And in this case, usually translated, the world, the eye of the world. Universal consciousness is, then we can say, single-eyed, holding in its singular vision the entire range of manifest and unmanifest principles. And this is why, in one sense, the heavenly man reflects all that is in the divine mind, which is indeed all the archetypal patterns, and passes on that reflection. So it is single-eyed, holding within its the singularity of vision all that is now lit up. It's as though, well, many of you have heard me use this analogy before, or this correspondence before. Prema Ashish in Man, the Measure of All Things, point out that within this, within the primordial, anything is possible, because darkness, anything. Once the cosmic egg is broken open, as it were, and is illumined, you are confined to what is. And you've heard me many times, and I'll just repeat it at the risk of boring you, that marvelous passage in Han Suhin's book, Love is a Many Splendored Thing, when she describes walking across the darkened airfield in Chongqing during the war years, and towards the airport, towards the terminal building, which of course was all black curtains and so on because of the war, and she stepped into the brightly lighted airport building, and she makes a marvelous statement, not that the light revealed so much more, but that it defined so much less. And I think this is always what light does. It defines what is present. When you enter a dark room, anything can be there, as I've pointed out before. You enter a room that is in pitch blackness, and anything can be there. You know, people and tables and chairs and ants and rats and cockroaches and, you know, dragons, and everything can be there. You put on the light, and then you are faced with what is actually there. And so in this same sense, the illumined, now within the mind, the archetypes, but now able to take many, many images, yes, but what is present is now perceivable, as it were. And so this single-eyed Loksha Shakshu, as she calls it in the shloka, now holds in its singular vision the entire range of manifest and unmanifest principles. There is but one consciousness, in other words, witnessing the phenomenal aspects of its own noumenal principles. And this, then, in one sense, because we are parts of that one witness, just as all of the cells of my body are held together, cohere, because of the totality of my physical structure, and I say this is my body, so perhaps I am just one cell in this witnessing consciousness in the heavenly man, doing my own thing within that larger body, so to speak.
You say that the idea of the witnessing consciousness infer the idea of the anthropomorphic God?
I think so. I think very much so. Yes. Yes. A distortion of that. Yes. Now, the pattern holds true at every level, as we shall see. If we see that one eye as the sun around which all the planets revolve, we have the astronomical symbolism of the shloka. If we perceive that one eye as the immortal Atman, round which all the principles of man are ever revolving, held within the orbit of that Atman which is universal, we have a psychological symbolism. And again, that one eye, which is called in the very first stanza, Shloka 8 of Volume 1, the opened eye of the Dhamma, the eye of Shiva, that eye of the purified soul, Mahatma, whose opened eye is the faculty of spiritual intuition. That one eye is also Dharma, Ritta in the Vedic tradition, that by which one perceives an invisible yet ordered pattern, so that all seemingly random events are held within the orbit of purpose and meaning. One can continue this symbolism of that single image, but perhaps enough has been said to realize that there is a magnificent pattern that is now reiterated in this very first shloka. Ashish puts it very beautifully. The world is a picture book of symbols, each page of which tells us some inner truth about ourselves, and our lives are myths whose every event is expressive of cosmic harmony. You know, P.L. Travers, who of course did Mary Poppins, and who is, of course, a very great psychologist also, you may know, not just a storyteller, suggests that we are all writing our own myths. We're the hero of our own stories. You see. The pattern is there. Well, the pattern, I guess, is to have some coffee or tea at this point. Make your own diagrams. Try to fit in these various things. I think it really begins to help as you work around with these ideas. Well, anyway, with this brief introduction, let's take a closer look at the first shloka to disentangle some, at least, of its meaning in relation to man's origin on this planet. First, as I've said, the word La, L-H-A, means simply a planetary spirit. In other words, the embodied intelligence responsible for this planet. Now, remember that a fundamental principle of the theosophical worldview of the esoteric tradition is that consciousness is all-pervasive. All is rooted in consciousness, universal consciousness, the divine mind, as we had it up there, however you want to express it. And therefore, all is expressive of some aspect. Now, that does not mean it's self-conscious, of course, but everything intelligence came first, to use that wonderful title of Dr. Lester Smith's work. So, as HBB states in her commentary, the word law, L-H-A, is simply the Tibetan term for any celestial or superhuman being, and it covers the whole series of heavenly hierarchies. Now, one of the things that we will be getting into, but not in the immediate future, but I'll just remind you of, because in earlier sessions we have discussed it, the beginning of any new period of activity, the new period which is called Manvantara, in effect is a reawakening of all that has been before at the stage. This is why, you know, the great myth of Sleeping Beauty and so on, we have it in many mythologies, that everything that goes to sleep, as it were, at the culmination of a cycle, reawakens. And we had this, of course, in the first shlokas, the reawakened energies with the outturning. And these energies, these sparks, these existences now taking, stepping in, as it were, at the same level. You go to sleep at night, you don't wake up in the morning suddenly endowed with some superhuman powers that you didn't have the night before. This is of course, this doesn't mean there can't be quantum leaps in our knowing, and I think there are quantum leaps, if you like to put it that way. This kind of evolution, punctuated evolution, if you like, but that really there is a progression. And so everything that, and this is called simply the shistas, doctrine of the shistas, or the seeds which are there and which now bring forth, each at its own level. And so we have then, as she puts it, grades of spirits or intelligences, each an intelligence responsible for certain matters, and at the same time involved in its own evolution. And so, as we pointed out yesterday, the evolution of our planet moves pari passu with the evolution of the consciousness of those inhabiting the planet. And so there is a direct correspondence. And this, incidentally, as I say, is a point we sometimes forget. But it's a significant point that however lofty the status, if you like, of any intelligent being within the manifested system, whether termed law or angel or spirit, or by any other term, whether you use Tibetan, Greek, Hindu, English, whatever, however advanced a grade occupied by such a being, that being also is evolving. This is an extremely important point. We sometimes forget this, that everything within a manifested system is evolving. And this is why, of course, the teaching as given by HPB is simply that there is no conceivable beginning nor imaginable end.
Would you agree that therefore all such levels of being are subject to error?
Yes, of course. And failure. And, you know, there have been, we've been pointed out, there have been systems that have failed. You see. And we are certainly at that very critical point, and this is pointed out in many places and in many traditions, a very critical point where we could fail. It's not absolutely assured. What is assured is that ultimately, perhaps there will be success, but you know, it may take us a few more manvantaras than had been planned, let us say. But certainly, this is very true. Now, in this case, The intelligence referred to by this term law, the law turns the wheel, the intelligence being referred to here is often called the regent or the watcher of this particular planet. Sometimes the rector of the fourth, which is, as I've said, our Earth, the fourth planet in our present planetary chain, and quite obviously is the man-bearing planet of our cycle. But note that this intelligence, this law, is subservient to what the shloka calls the law of the seven, indicating, as I've just said, a hierarchical system. There is, in other words, an intelligence overseeing the entire planetary chain. So you see, you have laws upon laws, so to speak, and that is the law of the seven here term. Earlier, you remember, in volume 1, page 233, HPB has told us, it must be explained and remembered that as the work of each round is said to be apportioned to a different group of so-called creators or architects, so is that of every globe. That is, it is under the supervision and guidance of special builders and watchers, the various Dianchohans. So, you see, just as John can say he's somewhat subservient to me as the director of the school, I'm subservient to the head of Crotona, at least to the board of trustees of Crotona. That's the board of laws, which meets once a month and so on. And that board may be subservient to something else and so on, you see. And hence, there is a graduated scale, and we take our places within it. So as we've commented on previous occasions, we have to become familiar with some of the multiple terms that are used throughout the secret doctrine. For example, while the entire hierarchy of watchers, the entire hierarchy of watchers are generally referred to as the Dianchohans, or really lords of meditation. Chohan is simply a word meaning lord, and Dian is from Dhyani, which is a meditative condition, a meditative state of contemplation. The regents of a planetary system, that is, those who have regency over the rounds of a chain of seven globes, are usually termed Dhyani Buddhas. So you have to become used to these terms. And so we have the law as a regent of a planet, or the law of the seven, entire planetary chain, the Dianchohans, who are then responsible for who are the entire hierarchy of laws, life, and are often used for those who oversee all of that, and these as for the rounds within the chain. So you have a number of different words, and we have to become accustomed to them. The regents of the globes within are not only termed laws, but also are often termed Dhyani Bodhisattvas. So that you again have So you have to get used to these. Those who watch over the root races or these major developmental stages within a round are often called the superterrestrial bodhisattvas, or more familiarly in the Brahmanical system. So within the chain, the rounds, and within the rounds, the races or developmental stages, these are usually termed the Manus, or the superterrestrial bodhisattvas. So these are a lot of terms, but you have to begin to get familiar with them. And at times, and these, incidentally, are assisted by the Manushya Buddhas, another term that sometimes comes in. The Manus assisted by the Manushya Buddhas. So we have a great number of terms, and it may be confusing at times. I don't deny, but what it is confusing. Unless one develops a kind of diagram of the hierarchies of intelligence. We can point out, you see, that frequently we think the ancients had no notion of the rotation of the planets on their axes and their movement around the sun. But this was well known in ancient astronomy, and many ancient texts make reference to the revolution of the planets around the sun. So don't think this was a Copernican discovery solely in the West. And while many a contemporary astronomer may ridicule some of the ancient observatories as simply places of astrological significance, the science of astrology in the days in the Chaldean system, of course, was firmly based on a knowledge of astronomy. I realize it's comparatively recent in terms of history, but since it was certainly built after the Muslim invasion of northern India. But I was so struck when I first went out to India with the famous Jantar Mantar in Delhi, which is this observatory, and beautifully built, isn't it? Beautifully built. Some of you have seen it, of course. And one can't help but be struck with the exactness of the measurements, indicating, of course, the knowledge that was always possessed by the Persians, a knowledge that was preserved through the centuries from the days of the Magi. Well, I think HBB's entire commentary at this point is well worth our review. This is pages 22 and 23 of Volume 2. And as she says, the ancients had in their Kyrielle of gods seven chief mystery gods, whose chief was exoterically the visible sun, or the eighth, and esoterically the second logos, the demiurge. The seven, who have now become the seven eyes of the Lord in the Christian religion, perhaps the seven spirits before the throne, but were the regents of the seven chief planets, that is, the seven sacred planets. But these were not reckoned according to the enumeration devised later by people who had forgotten or who had an inadequate notion of the real mysteries, and included neither the sun, the moon, nor the earth. Now, tomorrow when we look at these, we will see that the sun and the moon are often included as substitutes for two which are not named, and of course the earth is not among the sacred planets, and perhaps for a very good reason. The sun was the chief, exoterically, of the 12 great gods, or zodiacal constellations, and esoterically the Messiah, the Christos, the subject anointed by the great breath, or the One, surrounded by his 12 subordinate powers, also subordinate in turn to each of the seven mystery gods of the planets. Now, I find it interesting, for example, that HPB used the term Kyriel, which is the French verse form, which is usually octosyllabic, indicating again a marvelous, you know, in their Kyriel of gods, seven chief mystery gods under the eighth, exoterically, the visible sun, esoterically, the second logos. And so it is a kind of octosyllabic hierarchy. Well, before we take up the subject of the seven sacred planets, which we will have to do, and as I intend to do tomorrow, let's consider for a moment the next sentence in the shloka. His breath gives life to the seven. Barborka, in The Peopling of the Earth, which again is a book I highly recommend for your study, points out that this has a dual significance. First, the sun's breath quite literally gives life to the seven globes of the earth chain. The sun's prana gives life to the seven sacred planets. The sun's vitality, that is, that mystery planet, which is represented by the sun. Now, as we well know, the sun has often been called, and particularly so in many ancient texts, the giver of life. And you may recall that in Volume 1, towards the conclusion of the summing up to the first section, HPB gives us some very lengthy extracts from what she calls a private commentary. And there's a fascinating section. This is pages 289 and 290 of Volume 1. Surya, the sun, in its visible reflection, exhibits the first or lowest state of the seventh, the highest state of the universal presence, the pure of the pure, the first manifested breath of the ever unmanifested sut or beingness. All the central physical or objective suns are in their substance the lowest state of the first principle of the breath. So that the solar logos in that sense, or the sun which represents the solar logos, if you like, is the lowest state of the primary outpouring of the one, the lowest, so the seventh. The real substance, she says, of the concealed sun is a nucleus of mother substance. The seventh essence is the primordial mother substance, which is also the inner essence, acting as the inner kernel around which the outer substance or matter comprising a globe is concreted. It is the heart and matrix of all the living and existing forces in our solar system. It is the kernel from which proceed to spread on their cyclic journeys all the powers that set in action the atoms in their functional duties, and the focus within which they again meet in their seventh essence every 11th year. Now, it's interesting, for one thing, that she uses this 11th year. May remind us of the 11-year sunspot cycle, said to be due to the contraction of the solar heart. So it's a rather interesting.
Yeah. The Mayans call the sun the heart of heaven.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes, I always get the Mayan mythology and so on from Ruth, as many of you know, and I'm always grateful because it's a I'm gradually learning more about it thanks to Ruth. The heart of heaven.
Okay.
Wonderful. And, of course, it is this contraction and so on, the 11-year sunspot cycle, which is fascinating. Well, she gives further meaning to this, to the statement, his breath gives life to the seven. In a commentary, which comes on page 23 of Volume 2, because she says this refers as much to the sun who gives life to the planets as to the High One, the spiritual sun, who gives life to the whole cosmos. Now that we can take as Maha, the universal mind, the spiritual sun, the high one, which really is responsible for all then that is going to develop in a manifested system. So she says, the astronomical and astrological keys opening the gate leading to the mysteries of theogony can be found only in the later glossaries which accompany the stanzas. In the apocalyptic shlokas of the archaic records, the language is as symbolical, if less mythical, than in the Puranas. She, of course, as you know, refers again and again to these marvelous allegories in the Hindu Puranas. Absolutely wonderful. But she says, without the help of the later commentaries, compiled by generations of adepts, it would be impossible to understand the meaning correctly. In the ancient cosmogonies, the visible and the invisible worlds are the double links of one and the same chain. So that for every visible, there is an invisible counterpart, if you like. You see? Which, of course, is fundamental to the philosophy. So she says, as the invisible logos, with its seven hierarchies, represented or personified each by its chief angel or rector, law, regent, watcher, form one power, the inner and the invisible, so in the world of forms, the sun and the seven chief planets constitute the visible and active potency. So when we're talking about the seven sacred planets, we're not talking about the visible planets in our particular astronomical system, in our solar system, but rather with that which is the invisible potency, the power which is represented by these. Not always an easy idea to grasp. So the latter hierarchy, that is in the world of forms, the sun and the seven chief planets, being, so to speak, the visible and objective logos of the invisible and ever subjective angels. She might just as well have said laws, but she uses angels at this point. Now, note here, of course, that the term logos is really equivalent to regent. In a sense, again, one has to be very careful over this confusion of words, because she is now using this word logos as the regent or watcher, the planetary spirit, because, and I think the reason she does is because the word logos, as you know very well, contains within it a wealth of meaning. First of all, word, verbum, sound, creative potential, but also order, rationality, or logic, as, you know, which is, of course, from logos. So there is an order, there is a pattern present that is manifesting itself, an archetypal pattern. And again, I think we have to come back to the question that has been asked, Phil asked it, and so on, that is this already a kind of preordained, or is there freedom within it? And I think that we have to admit that there must be freedom within it. But it's still order. One finds this, of course, in the Vedas, in that wonderful word Rita, in the Rig Veda. So, a qualifying adjective probably is necessary, and Barborka points this out, when using the term logos in this sense. In this case, the commentary refers to the invisible logos, which we often term the first logos or the unmanifest logos, and then in the commentary there's the reference to the objective or the third logos, the creative logos. And HPB details the progression in her further elaboration to this phrase, his breath gave life to the seven. In effect, her commentary reviews for us what is the entire Logos doctrine in the emanation of a manifested system. And it's well worth studying, pages 24 and 25, therefore, of volume 2. Because here is this whole doctrine. Let me just excerpt the pertinent and most relevant part. At the commencement of a great Manvantara, Parabrahm manifests as Mula Prakriti and then as the Logos, you see. Now, we've been through that, but I'm just bringing it in here again because it's important. And so we have this mirror reflecting then the archetypal realm, as she points out. And I suggest you study this very carefully. And so man becomes a logos in reflecting then from that logoic or divine mind or the invisible logos and makes objective. And so there is order in all that we do, but not an order that's always apparent, and consequently we suffer the consequences of it and call it karma. So we begin to see how, in a sense, we become a creative logos in our turn. Does this begin to show you where our responsibility? Well, there's one further passage in her commentary that we should take note of, which is, again, a further elucidation of the sun's giving life to the seven. She states, the seven higher make, she quotes first from the occult commentary, the seven higher make the seven laws create the world, which means that our earth, leaving aside the rest, as she says, was created or fashioned by those regions, by terrestrial intelligences, in which the laws, in a sense, were the supervisors. And here she makes a very important distinction, as she has before, between architects and builders. You know, that there are those who draw up the plan, but they're not necessarily the builders, as we know. People, architects can draw up a beautiful plan, and sometimes we say it won't work, because there you are right on the ground doing it, building it, and what the architect has in mind simply won't work. So here again is perhaps where, you know, you need the builders to say what will or will not work within a particular system. So this is the first germ, HPB says, the seed of that which grew later into the tree of astrology and astrolatry. The higher ones were the fabricators of our solar system. The Greek term that she uses is cosmokratoris. This is borne out by all the ancient cosmogonies. Heaven's belt, the signs of the zodiac, the sacred animals, are as much the sons of the gods or the Elohim as the spirits of the earth. Soma and Sin, Isis and Diana, are all lunar gods or goddesses, called the fathers and mothers of our earth, which is subordinate to them. But these, in their turn, are subordinate to their fathers and mothers. So again we get this graduated hierarchical scale. So that our fathers and mothers are the sons of other fathers and mothers, sons and daughters of other fathers and mothers. So it's always in relationship in this hierarchical scale. So we have, as I say, the builders of the cosmos, either a solar system or a planetary system. And she gives us a very interesting, Larry, there's a section in the what I pointed out to you yesterday, the esoteric writings, at the end of this work, which is volume 3 originally, or volume 6 in the Adyar edition, she tells us, she speaks of these intelligences who are the builders, to whom she gives the Greek term. It's interesting, having used all of these Sanskrit and Tibetan terms, she then uses for the builders the Greek term, the cosmokratoros. The cosmos and builders, creators, fashioners. And she tells us, it's page 5, I may not have put down the exact, no I didn't, it's volume 5 of the Adyar edition, page 534, it's in notes on some oral teachings, and I didn't put down the reference in this one, which I should have done. She speaks of these as that they build on planes in the divine mind, visible to them, though not to us. So this is why, you see, Phil, I'm saying, you see, that what we call arupa is rupa to other intelligences. Because here she says, they build on planes in the divine mind, visible to them, but not to us. Now, much more of this is given by her in an essay which is in this volume on symbolism of sun and stars. It's a very fascinating section in this. It's on page 309 of the third of the volume 5. And in this particular work, thought I had it. I don't see it at the moment. Page 258 in this edition of it, the Esoteric Writings of H.P. Blavatsky. And it's a fascinating section, you know, which of course gets into what she thinks of some of the Christian churches, but also of the reference to of Saint Paul speaking of the cosmokratoros. These are builders, but builders in the divine mind, which is visible to them. So they would hear the tree falling in the forest even if you weren't there. You see. Well, perhaps I should pause at this point and ask if there are any questions. Maybe I shouldn't, because I'm not sure I can answer any questions. Yes, Diane?
I have one that I've been struggling with, and that it gets back to your Dhyanibodhisattva Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
If the consciousness of our planet, our Dhyani Chalan or Dhyani Bodhisattva, evolutionary development follows ours, that mm-hmm. is the human monad, I had assumed that therefore when we move on to the next globe in our mm-hmm. round, so would that consciousness. But yet, in the Secret Doctrine, it says that each globe has its own Dhyani Chalan.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And in which case, where is the evolutionary pattern for the Dhyani Chalan?
You see, there is an interplanetary obscuration, period of rest. So one may assume that just as we have become accustomed on our planet to a 24-hour cycle, during 8 of which, and I'm just being, you know, during 8 of which we need to rest, so it appears by analogy, by correspondence, and this is set forth later in this volume, the Dhyani, the regent, the law, the Dhyani Chohan of Dhyan Chohan of the Watcher, needs a period of rest, which may well be equivalent to a kind of devachanic or nirvanic condition of assimilation of the entire experience of the planetary day, the day of Brahma, so to speak. And meanwhile, moving to the next globe, which is an inner globe, reawakens the Yan Chohan of that particular globe, the regent, who must now wake up and get about his business because he's now got some things to look after, the monads that are there. So it seems to me there's a kind of analogy in that.
Well, I'm going to get some thoughts following. So does our Yan Chohan go through a period of rest?
Yes.
And wake up on the next globe?
No. Would reawaken on this globe when only
in the fifth round.
That's right, in the fifth round.
Okay, so
now when the seventh round is completed,
okay,
he becomes, as it were, the intelligence which will be responsible for a similar state in the next planetary chain.
So what is a chain for us would be analogous to a round.
That's right.
Our round is his chain.
Is his chain.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then he has seven of those before he can become the Yan
Buddha. This is where it is helpful sometimes to make yourself a little diagram. And I didn't put it on the board. We've had enough diagrams this morning, but make one for yourself. But you see, there is a correspondence there. Because he has to go through, just as you see, we have a number of incarnations to achieve what is to be the goal of this humanity. At the end of the seventh round, we have goals, intermediate goals. The goal of this round, the goal of, we have intermediate goals, but we also have a goal for the end of the seventh race in the seventh round. So he has a goal for the seven, for the...
So that our consciousness then really is not linked with the consciousness
I think it's in coadjunition but not consubstantiation. Yes. That word coadjunition is a marvelous word, you see. I mean, it really has a lot of implications in it, and I think our consciousness must be in relationship but not consubstantial.
Isn't that awful?
I know it. I mean, we're so comfortable on this one. It's a shame that we have to leave it someday. But we'll be back. Bill?
On the sacred planets, you said that the Earth is obviously a man-buried, but it's not a sacred planet. And in one of Jim's talks, he said the sacred planets are defined as man-buried.
They're man-bearing only in the sense, they're not, at least as I read the material on them, both in the secret, I know I could be quite wrong, but as I understand it, they are not man-bearing in the same sense that this planet is man-bearing. That is to say that they are man-bearing in the sense that they provide nurseries for future monads that assist this humanity's, the monads of this that are now in our present humanity. And so they give to this humanity the gifts of, as it were, of their unique capacities, functions, qualities, I don't know what word to use. And so they are related, all related, because actually ours being the fourth creative hierarchy, this particular humanity has received the gifts of the gods of all of them. So man-bearing in one sense, but not in another sense. Can I put it that way? As I read it, at least. Yeah.
Could the planets possibly be such areas as clairvoyancy, clairaudiency?
They might be. I think that could be an interpretation. I hadn't thought of that interpretation, but they might be certainly related to the siddhis. It's quite possible. There's much we don't know about them, and that's why I say it. It's always quite possible, and that would be an interesting interpretation.
Which would make the hierarchy seem to make sense.
Yes.
In defining your terms for the hierarchy here, I'm familiar with terms like avatar and masters and saints and yogis. Is that on a lower level?
That would be on a lower level. That would be within
the particular. Yes.
You see, the very term, it's interesting, the very term manvantara, which is used, the Sanskrit word, which is used for a period of manifestation, actually means antara is between. It's actually between two manus, you see. Now, you have to be sure of what you mean by manu, because the manu is a ruler or regent or a great lord of compassion, or a great lord of contemplation, meditation. There are, in other words, periods of activity, and this generally can be translated as that, between two manus of developmental stages, or what we call root races. As you know, I hate that term, root races, so I always preface it or follow it with developmental stages, because that's what they are. And each developmental stage is under a particular ruler or manu. And so you have, for example, in India, the code of Manu, which was given for a particular people, as it were. Now, within that period, you have those who embody in some way the shall we say, the greater life, the divine life, as an avatar, or who represent through achievement a certain stage, as the great yogis, sages, saints, rishis, and so on. But within that period of... So again, you say it's sort of the Chinese box puzzle, isn't it?
I can't quite get that, between...
Yes, actually, this is a double, so it's between two manus.
But I thought that the period of manifestation in the cycle was subject to a manu.
It is. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you why, but this is the literal meaning of the word, manu.
Well, we have to accept that. Yeah. It's puzzling.
Yeah, it is puzzling, because it is the period of activity during which a manu is in charge, as it were, is awake. Has moved out of obscuration.
Isn't it broken down into, you know, root and seed? The root and seed?
Yes, the root and seed. Yes, there are the root manus and seed manus. Yes, that goes too. Yes. Anna?
Joy, there's the well-known axiom, as above, so below. And so I'm wondering how we can find a reflection of this hierarchical scheme here on Earth. Just now, perhaps, we touched on it when we spoke of avatars and so on. This young man mentioned the scheme that we hear of. In our affairs, and in our evolution, in the scheme of levels that we've seen on Earth, where hierarchy is understood not in the way you described the theme of Crotona, for example, with the board and everybody responsible for the other person. It is a different kind
I think it's a different kind of hierarchy, and it follows the general systems theory von Puchelon theory, of course. I think so. It's a shall we say a lateral hierarchy.
And the logos is a composite. Everything
yes.
is composite. Also, and
yes.
therein lies freedom.
Too. Yes, that's right. Yes. Mm-hmm. So I think in many ways it's both vertical and horizontal, both vertical and lateral.
I think there's probably a clue somewhere in this that at our level of experience, when we look at from below and we look hypothetically into higher levels of consciousness, if we can be there, we're told that we will experience form.
Mm-hmm.
But that when it's brought through in consciousness, and then hence to mind, it's not. So in other words, at say the Buddhic level, there is form,
mm-hmm.
which comes through as intuition or
mm-hmm.
wisdom
mm-hmm.
knowledge, which is formless until
mm-hmm.
it's made form in some way,
mm-hmm.
and so on all the way up through. Now,
mm-hmm.
This is paradoxical, but it seems to me that there is a continuity, a hierarchical continuity
mm-hmm.
all the way up. As we below the upwards, we can't see form.
Yes.
We can only experience to a very, very
mm-hmm.
limited extent, and it only becomes any sort of form through consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when we experience it in consciousness, for instance, mind form at the mental level becomes formless thought.
Mm-hmm.
Whichever way we look at it, we
yes.
get inversion.
Get inversion, yes.
It's extremely confusing to mm-hmm. set up any sort of a pattern.
It really is. It's very difficult to. This is the problem, I think, always.
Yeah.
But I think it's fun sometimes to try to set a pattern, and then one begins to see, well, that doesn't quite fit in, and then we have to change it, and so on. And it's only from that point of view that one begins to play around with these.
Do you think perhaps that the so-called illumination of the spiritual masters is a point at which we begin to see the meaning and form?
I think so. I think it must be. I think it must be. Mm-hmm.
Still is touching, and not for the first time today, I think, on a subject that's revolving in my mind too. I think in our discussions in this semester on subjectivity and objectivity,
mm-hmm.
Which we touched on so much, we're touching in a way on that. And would you say that our process of development all the time is a continuous redefinement of what is objective for us?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point, Anna. I think that's very true. Yes, and Phil has touched on it. I think that's very true. It points it up. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've been very patient this morning. It's not been easy, but nobody promised us a rose garden when we opened the secret doctrine. So at least it's fun.